say that services are being rendered in a proper way.
Right. I have to interrupt here because we're out of time, but could you tell us how people can find out more information about this situation? Is there a website? And maybe they can find out something about what they can do if they're interested in helping.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So if you go to avid.chihuahuan.org, our report is hosted there. We'll make sure it's on the front page of our website. So that's where you can read more about the report.
All right. Well, we will come back to you. We appreciate this work. It's incredibly important, Nathan Craig. So thank you for taking the time out to make the information available. And we will continue this dialogue. Please stay safe.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your attention to this.
Sure. And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints. The Dems are still winning. Stay tuned.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions,
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show. I'm your host, Tori Bortman. For the past year, the Bike Show has made a continued effort to elevate voices not usually heard in connection with cycling. Unfortunately, cycling is and has been mostly dominated by white males, and that echo chamber has led to the stories and voices outside of that definition not having a platform or being heard. But there are many Black, Indigenous, and people of color who ride bikes, and their stories are as rich, interesting, and full of adventure and history as any of those that have dominated the cycling industry and community up until now. This month, our guests are leaders, ambassadors, keepers of history, and inspiration to those around them and beyond. They all come from different tribes within North America, but are similarly dedicated to the issues that affect their families and those of all Indigenous and Native peoples. In the first half of our show, my co-host, Alon Robb, will be speaking with Sky Wildcat of the Cherokee Nation, exploring her work as Miss Cherokee and her experiences with the Remember the Removal Ride, which retraces the steps of the 1,000-mile trek her ancestors walked during their forced removal by the United States government from their ancestral lands, commonly known as the Trail of Tears. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by pro cyclist Shayna Paulus of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin and National Football League defensive end Ili Enku of the Ojibwe Tribe to talk about their Dreamcatcher Foundation. Their mission is to, quote, empower future generations of Native American women and children through love, respect, courage, honesty, wisdom, humility, and truth. But first, here's my co-host, Alon Robb, with the Bike Show News Minute, followed by his interview with Sky Wildcat.
In the midst of a year of suffering and debt, there have been also sources of light and hope, including the increase in cycling across the globe. In villages, towns, and even big cities long associated with cars, including Los Angeles and Houston, bicycle sales are up, and the number of cyclists is on the rise. A BBC report titled The Great Bicycle Boom of 2020 describes how heightened anxiety over public transportation and a growing awareness over the importance of exercise and healthy living is causing more and more people to use bicycles. Manufacturers and bike stores are struggling to keep up with demand, while cities have redesigned streets to accommodate an influx of riders. Even before the pandemic, millions relied on bicycles to get to their jobs and also for work. but lockdowns and social distancing on public transportation and in public spaces have emphasized the important role of the vehicle. According to research by People for Bikes, 1 in 10 American adults reported having ridden a bike for the first time in a year or longer since the onset of COVID-19, and ridership on trails in the U.S. has reached a threefold increase compared with the same period in 2019. People were at home with nothing to do, a bike sitting in their garage with flat tires, says Morgan Lomel, director of state policy at People for Bikes. One of the barriers to bicycling across the ages is anxiety about a thing with 100 moving parts. People worry, how do I store it? How do I fix it? But lockdown changed that. Suddenly, everyone had the time to tinker. In Europe, many governments have offered incentives rewarding the purchase of new bikes or bike maintenance expenses in a bid to encourage ridership. Italy, for example, allocated $250 million towards a cashback program which grants Italian residents who purchased a vehicle without an engine a $600 stipend. Will this increase in cycling become permanent? Municipalities and bicycle organizations are hoping that the new riders will continue to cycle along new and improved cycling lanes. Every year, members of the Cherokee Nation ride nearly 1,000 miles from Nuecota, Georgia to Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Taking part in the Remember the Removal bike ride, the cyclists honor their ancestors who during the 1830s were violently removed from their lands in the southeast. The ride follows along the northern path of the Trail of Tears in remembrance of the thousands who died and of the great suffering. Today's guest, Sky Wildcat, who is a Cherokee, Muscogee Creek, is an activist and community leader who participated in the 2018 ride. A graduate of Northeastern State University, Oklahoma, she is a student services coordinator for the Center of Tribal Studies. Currently, Sky Wildcat is a doctoral student in the University of Arkansas's higher education program. Hello, Sky Wildcat, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Today we'll talk about the ride you participated in 2018, but before we get to the ride, can you tell us a little bit about your own history and background?
My family, of course, came over on the Trail of Tears back in around 1836, 1838, and so I guess come over is a really light, actually very light, and not true word to use, but they were forcibly removed from the southeastern region of the United States, which was not the United States then. It was still native land. And so they were forcibly removed on what they referred to as when we were driven. And so they came from that area to what is now Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And so I grew up around the Tahlequah area, the Muscogee area, the Fort Gibson area. And my grandparents live in Vianne, which is kind of where they've settled down. I have a lot of family out there. And so I was fortunate to have some of the traditions that we practiced before the Trail of Tears to be able to have those now, because a lot of the culture and traditions for Cherokee people were lost on the Trail of Tears due to historical trauma. A quarter of our people died during that time. And so there was just a lot. And of course, the suppression from the U.S. government, you know, not being able to practice our religion or even language, boarding schools, all of that, colonization in general. But I am lucky that my grandparents are both speakers, and my grandma is a fluent Cherokee speaker. So she, of course, raised my dad, who teaches Cherokee language at Fort Gibson High School and also at Rogers State University. And so growing up, I went with him all over the state of Oklahoma, like weaving baskets, teaching people how to weave baskets, playing games with stickball. He would make me use the language a lot. Of course, I'm not anywhere near any sort of fluency, but I grew up hearing the language and being around Cherokee language. And so, for example, when he was teaching me how to drive, he would tell me the directions in Cherokee, or if I wanted to go to a friend's house, he would tell me, you know, to learn the colors and to learn the numbers and to be able to ask for things in Cherokee. So I definitely took a lot of that for granted until I got to NSU, the university that I got my undergrad in, and realized, wow, like, not everybody you know, grow up like that. And I knew that going to elementary school, it was predominantly white, and I didn't really have a lot of people around me that grew up in a similar culture or environment. But when I got to college is when I was like, wow, you know, I'm really lucky that I was able to grow up this way. So that's a little bit about where I'm from and who I come from, which is, of course, a good custom to do is introducing everybody and telling them who I belong to. So my grandparents are Leveda and French Wildcat, and my dad is Victor Wildcat, and my mom is Tammy Wildcat. And so I belong to the Wildcat and Smith families from the Muscogee Creek and Cherokee Nations.
What were some of the traditions that your parents and grandparents shared with you about your people, the land?
So my dad, that part is a little hard to explain sometimes because there's the ceremony that Cherokee people have is called a stop dance or gatiyu, and I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, but unfortunately we didn't get to go to those ceremonies, and which is basically a time of prayer. They dance around a fire, and the women wear turtle shells on their ankles to keep the beat and to, you know, kind of help keep the men on track, and the men will sing, and those are the prayers go into the fire and they go up to Creator. But my dad at home, since we were kind of in more of like an urban setting, a lot of times if I was having like bad dreams or something like that, then he would know what to do to kind of help curb those bad dreams or trying to figure out why I was having them or why these bad things were happening. And he also taught me how to go and gather wild onions. I would go out with him into the woods, and he would actually find trees to cut to make things like stickball sticks, which is a traditional game that we play, and bows. He could even gather traditional materials for basket reed, and which are all really good skills to have and something that I'm still trying to learn myself. And, of course, the language, like I talked about earlier. So those are a few of the traditions that were able to be sustained within my family. And, again, I'm really thankful for that. And my grandma, actually, and my grandpa, they both had to go to boarding school. So there is where the history, you can see it change and transform. Because my grandma's dad was Redbird Smith, her grandpa, his name was Redbird Smith, and he was a traditional leader. He was the one who brought the stomp dances and the ceremony back to Tahlequah. But when she went to boarding school, she was more of exposed to Christianity and really put into that lifestyle. And so that's what she practices now. And so it's you can definitely see what colonization does and how it affects your own family. And so now I'm between kind of like, okay, I don't want to practice Christianity. I don't want to focus on that kind of belief and that lifestyle, but I want to learn more about my traditions and my ceremony and what it means to really honor Creator and honor all creation. And so I'm kind of at that point, and I think a lot of people within my generation are at that point. So it's really just an ongoing learning process right now.
And as far as the newer tradition, bicycles, did you ride a bicycle when you were a kid, or is that a fairly recent phenomenon?
So I did ride bikes as a kid, but I don't think it was anything out of the ordinary, out of like a normal kid growing up in the early 2000s, late 90s. But it wasn't until remember the removal bike ride that I was like, okay, this biking is a professional sport. And so remember the removal bike ride, we trained for 6 months prior to our departure to back east, and the training was, I mean, it could be brutal sometimes, and especially for someone who is not a cycler, who never really thought that, hey, this is you know, a lifestyle that I want to lead. But it definitely taught me so many values and lessons and the importance of who I am as a Cherokee person. And so now I do take the time to really appreciate what cycling does and what it can give to people. You know, it's more than fitness. It's acknowledging the land around you. You really slow down and are able to take in your environment. And that's something that I never thought about before, before I started, you know, cycling.
There's something about being on the bicycle with the wind, you know, across your face, and you're aware of the birds and everything. That's so immediate and real, and you definitely don't get it when you're inside a metal and glass car. So,
right.
How does one train for such a long ride?
So for Cherokee Nation, we would take every weekend for 6 months. And of course, when it was cold, before we actually got our bikes, we just did conditioning. Being in the gym every weekend together, and just doing different things between like the stationary bike to running, to lifting weights, to, you know, all of that. Just conditioning our body to even think about what it would be like on a bike. But of course, any exercise I don't think even compares to going up a really steep hill on a bike. Like I haven't found one that feels the same way. But so we did that, and then we take off for 3 weeks. But the preparation is really, it's a lot of it is on you. So when you're not training with your team on the weekends, you're supposed to be doing it during the week. And so as for myself, it was a little bit more difficult for me, and so it took a bit of time for me to get stronger to where I wanted to be, and I got to that point by making sure that I trained probably 3 to 4 times a week. If it was cold or dark, then, you know, I would go to the gym and just, you know, lift weights or do whatever I could to make my legs and everything stronger. But otherwise, I would just find some hills, some more isolated hills, and just ride those 3 or 4 times every day, and just keep getting my body used to the feeling of going up the hill and not stopping. You know, whenever you're out of breath and you're like, okay, I did that. Well, you know, you still can't stop because you have on the ride, you have a team of people behind you and in front of you, and you have to get to that point where you are working as a unit. So it's both individual and teamwork, and which I really liked about it. It was a good balance, but the training, again, was very rigorous. I think during the weekends, we would keep increasing our mileage from, you know, we started off with like 10 to 15 miles, and then I think we have to pass a test showing that we can ride at least 70 miles in one day. So we did that all together. We rode about, I think we ended up with about 76 miles or something like that in one day. That was our test. And then, of course, on the actual ride, the range varies, just depending on traffic and the weather and all those different factors.
And going up those brutal hills, it's a metaphor for life, right? Struggle and getting up. And then once you get up, you could go downhill, and it's much easier.
Yeah.
But it's getting up. It's getting up. That's the struggle. So who were the other riders? What promoted them? Were they mostly young people?
So for Cherokee Nation, the age cap was at that time 16 to 25, and then we had one mentor rider. And so, but for Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, who we met up with whenever we started the ride, they had no age cap. So I think the oldest person to complete the ride was about in their 70s, I think. But for my team, I think the oldest was in her 60s, and that was from Eastern Band. So it was a huge range of ages once we actually met up with the Eastern Band riders. And of course, that was also a learning curve at first, was learning to ride with more riders and a different team who had trained differently. You know, they already had their own setup, their own unit, and so we had to learn to merge with them and to do it the right way. Which we did. We caught on, and it was great. But for our ride, we go through a interview, and so they just ask you different questions. What do you know about the Trail of Tears? Have you ever done cycling before? What do you plan on doing after the ride? How can you handle conflict situations? Just different things, kind of assessing how you might be on the ride and what you know about your history. And then they take that and the committee decides on who gets selected. And so we started off with, I think, 10 team members, and then we finished with 8 or 9. So it just depends. But yeah, so that's, it definitely varies as far as motivation to do the ride.
You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, and our guest today is Sky Wildcat, and we're talking about the Remember the Removal bike ride, nearly 1,000 miles of cycling along the Trail of Tears. For those of our listeners who might not be familiar with the history, could you talk a little bit more about the Trail of Tears?
Yeah, so there were a few different routes that the Trail of Tears happened on, and of course Cherokee Nation wasn't the only tribe who was forcibly removed from the East. And so in 1838, the act was forced, is whenever the Trail of Tears had started, and even though it wasn't supposed to happen, Cherokees weren't supposed to be removed, Andrew Jackson still made that happen to us. And there was the Treaty of Nui Chota was signed by certain Cherokees, and they're known as the Treaty Party, and there was a lot of conflict with those that were in the Treaty Party, because the treaty, if you signed that treaty, that meant that you were giving up your land and your rights to that land, and that you were going to move. So of course there were conflicts between people who were saying, well, it's going to happen regardless, we have no choice, so we might as well be compliant and see if, you know, this helps our case, maybe it won't be so harsh. But then there were other people who said, no, we're going to fight, this is our, you know, this is where we belong, and they have no right to do this to us. And so there is, from the history of that, there was some outbreak, of course, some big conflict, because why wouldn't there be in a situation like that? And so Cherokees were fighting Cherokees, Treaty Party was fighting non-Treaty Party, and so, of course, the Trail of Tears did happen, and then the Cherokee Nation, amongst other tribes, were forcibly removed from the southeastern area, and then the route that we take on the bike ride is the northern route, so we go through 7 states, Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Then after removal, of course, we landed in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And to be in Tahlequah, Oklahoma is an interesting part of our history, because this is where we ended up and this is where we made the home. And there are some videos and some sayings that Cherokee people chose this place or were okay with this, not really okay with it, but they settled for Tahlequah because it looked like home. It had the same mountains. It had the same rivers. It just had that same feeling and scenery as what home was. And so there is a part of the Remember the Removal ride where you are crossing a river, and that's the last time that you can look back and see the mountains of what, you know, of where we once were. And so we cross a ferry just exactly like our ancestors did. They had to cross a ferry to get to the other side, to keep going, and they were actually forced to even pay for that ride. And so now that I think and I reflect on being on, you know, a ferry and crossing that river and seeing the same thing that they saw, it really is a resonating feeling. And, you know, that historical trauma that's lasted from the Trail of Tears comes all the way down to my generation and lower generations. And so now we're doing all that we can to heal that trauma and to be, or to really enforce that resilience that we know that we come from, but it's just having to remind ourselves of what we come from. And so the bike ride really helps with that. It reminds us of how resilient we are and where we come from. We see a lot of the historical sites where our people were kept and where they walked. We saw the actual land of their internment camps. We went to a place called Mammal Rock. It's quite a bit of a hike down there. And then it's just this huge, I mean, it's a rock, you know, it's a huge rock that they basically had to sleep under in the freezing cold. And to be able to be at those same sites is a crazy feeling. And while you're on the ride, you don't think about it too much, because, you know, you're tired and you're hungry and you're just like, man, like, it's hot outside, like, I'm tired, but, like, you're still taking in all those emotions, you know, it's just constantly packing on you and you're just taking it all in. And eventually, you know, when you get off the ride, I think even now I'm still decompressing from it. I'm still reflecting on what happened and what they went through and what we went through, and just piecing it all together.
sounds so powerful on so many levels. During the ride, how did people along the route receive you?
So we were fortunate to not really encounter any much negativity or anything like that. And actually, so there's a organization called the Trail of Tears Association now, and they have chapters all along the Trail of Tears route. And so every time that we had a stop, there was always a chapter there waiting for us. Always had food. They had people there, you know, wanting to talk to us and just see us along on our journey, encourage us, help us. And so that was amazing to see. And that also resonates because you know that that was the opposite of what our ancestors had on the Trail of Tears. And to think about, there were some towns that we went through that we had a police escort in front of us. And so they would stop the whole street, you know, everybody, all the cars would stop at their stoplights, and the street was just empty except for us. And so we were being escorted through town. And to think about the differences of us being escorted as a good thing, you know, everybody stopping to see us on our journey, to see us on our, you know, this huge milestone. But for them, they were being escorted in a different way. You know, they were being forced. And so that is something that I think about a lot, is just even the police escort being there for us, but then for them, it was a different story. And so it's crazy to think about how far, like, things have transitioned and how our story has changed, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't negativity out there. And other riders in other years have experienced negativity. So I think we were just lucky on our year to not really have that. Aside from, you know, a dog, like, running up and biting your bike or something like that. But otherwise, yeah.
And sometimes history has a way where the arc of justice does bend in the good way. And it's what you described seemed like an example of that. You are a student of psychology and leadership. I'm wondering how this powerful event might help overcome adversity, or how does it help one become stronger, more able to face struggles in life?
Yeah, it definitely. There has been research done on, I think, 3 years of the ride, and it shows that after the ride, then, or during, whenever you're training for the ride and you get to the ride, then you're thinking about historical trauma a lot. But the research also shows that after the ride, that depression rates are lower, anxiety rates are lower, you feel more supported, and you think about historical trauma less, which is an interesting thing. And we don't know if that's just because of, you know, maybe you feel more resilient that you don't think about it so much, or maybe it's just because you're not consistently, you know, reading a journal about the Trail of Tears, or, you know, whatever we did in training. But aside from that, I think about the ride every day. And whenever I am going through something hard, whether it's physical or mental or whatever, then my mind immediately goes back to, if I can do that, if I can, you know, ride a bike for 3 straight weeks in the hot sun and just be constantly tested, then I can do this, you know, whatever else that is. But the leadership part is what is a central part of the Cherokee Nation's design for the ride. So each person takes a turn in leading the team for the day, which comes with a lot. It comes with you have a walkie-talkie on you, and you're listening to whatever cars are in front of you and behind you. We have a lead car, we have a police escort behind us, as well as a medic. And they're telling you, hey, you need to pull over, or hey, you need to slow down, or hey, your teammates are gapping, you know, they're way behind you. Different things that you have to listen for while you are riding the bike, while you are going up hills and trying to figure out and not get overwhelmed. And that is a huge leadership lesson, or at least it was for me. When I was leading, it's hard for me to hear sometimes. Like, I don't know what it is, but sometimes, or on the ride, whenever it was my turn to lead that day, and it was a hard day. Missouri is really hard to ride through. If anyone is from Missouri and rides a bike, I commend you so much, because riding through Missouri was horrendous. And so I had to lead probably a really hard day, arguably one of the hardest days. And it was just constant up and down, up and down. And so at one point, one of our escorts or one of the support staff had told us that we needed to pull over to let some cars pass. And so I didn't hear them the first time, and then later they got frustrated with me because I didn't hear them. But, you know, it was important. It was concerning the safety of us. And so I finally was able to get out of the way, but it was like on the middle of a hill, and so of course it's hard to start and stop on a hill. So some people kept going, and, you know, I just told them, if you need to go ahead of me, just go. Like, at first you're not supposed to pass the leader, but if it's on the hill and you need to go, then, you know, you have to go. So at that point, whenever I had pulled over, one of our other teammates had gotten frustrated, and he was just like, why did we stop? Like, I have to keep going. I don't know why we're doing this. And then I just lost it, because I just had all these people like getting frustrated with me, and I knew why they were getting frustrated, but it just felt like it was out of my control. And so I just remember just breaking down. And but when I broke down, it was like I had all of my teammates there with me, like just encouraging me, like, you know, letting me know, like just letting me take the time to just like let it all out, you know, just let the tears flow and just sit there for a minute. Like, time is not existent at that point. And that is like one of the greatest memories that I have on the ride. Even though it's one of the worst memories, it's one of the greatest memories, because I don't think I've ever felt that supported as much as I did in that moment, because they understood. They knew what I was going through, and I knew that they knew what I was going through. And the same thing had happened for people whenever they led on their days. And it's just a really daunting task. But as a leader, you have to understand that you're strong and, you know, you're going to be there for everybody. But you also have to know that whoever you're leading is going to be there for you, too. You have to trust in them and take value in what they're saying and you know, their perspective. So it's definitely probably the best thing that I've done with my life so far, and I'm sure a lot of my other teammates feel the same way.
You've been listening to the KBO Bike Show, and our guest was Sky Wildcat, who shared her insights and knowledge and experiences from remembering and following in the footsteps of the Trail of Tears. Thank you so much, Sky, and all the best in the new year to you and your family and loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We're now joined by pro cyclist Shayna Paulus of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin and National Football League defensive end Ili Anku of the Ojibwe Tribe to talk about their Dream Catcher Foundation. The foundation's mission is to empower future generations of Native American women and children through love, respect, courage, honesty, wisdom, humility, and truth. Much of the work they do is focused on impacting the women and children of Native American communities by providing funding for organizations fighting for the missing and murdered Indigenous women's movement. Their advocacy programs of sports camps they hold for tribal youth are intended to bring awareness to the fight against human trafficking and violence. For those listeners who are not familiar with the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement, Indigenous and Native women are murdered at a rate 10 times higher than other ethnicities, and according to the Centers for Disease Control, it's the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women. The majority of these murders are committed by non-Native people on Native-owned land. Because of the lack of communication between state, local, and tribal enforcement, it's difficult to begin the investigation process, and because of the historic racism and bias towards Indigenous peoples, but especially women, these cases are often not seen as worth investigating. Ili Anku and Shayna Paulus, welcome to the KBOO Bike Show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for having us.
So can you tell our listeners more about the Dream Catcher Foundation?
So the Dream Catcher Foundation is something that Ili and I started last year officially. It kind of came about a little early in the year last year. Both Ili and I, having Native backgrounds on both sides of our families, we feel a strong inclination to give back to the Native communities in any way that we can. Also, both of us being professional athletes, Ili a professional football player for the Cowboys, and then myself being a professional cyclist for a pro women's team, Team 2020, based here in the U.S., that's another reason why we feel inclined to give back to the communities in any way we can via sports camps. So that's kind of the focus of our Dreamcatcher Foundation, is providing youth sports camps for kids and more specifically providing sport camps that are easily accessible for Native American kids, Native American as well as Indigenous kids from those kinds of communities. And so last year, we were fortunate enough to be able to host our very first annual summer sports camp, which was held in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, Ely's hometown. And it was a huge turnout. It was about 150 kids, so it was maxed out. So the participation was amazing. And it did have a football focus. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to be there. I was competing at the Road National Championships that same weekend, unfortunately. But my goal is to be at the next one. I'll make sure that I'm there and present. And we're also toying with the idea of hopefully at our next camp or at some point in the future for one of our camps in the future to even incorporate some cycling into the sports camp as well as football. So we would like to kind of tie in both sports into one camp, hopefully. Maybe down the line we could even host more than one camp per year where one is more football focused or one is more cycling focused instead of tying them both into one. But we're still kind of just thinking of ideas for our next camps in the future. And unfortunately this year we weren't able to host a camp due to COVID, but next year our goal is to host our second annual camp at some point during next summer.
So the Dream Catcher Foundation is still a bit in its infancy, partially in extended infancy due to COVID, it sounds like.
No question. Basically, you know, with having started last year, kind of we got our feet on the ground, and then this year it was kind of tough, you know, obviously with all the things going on, and we can't rush anything like that, so we feel that it gives us extra time to prepare for the next one that we do. And obviously it doesn't have to be, you know, just football, just cycling. It can be pretty much anything. The goal right here is to get kids out and get them playing, get them active, and obviously give them a platform to where they can find someone they look up to and, you know, figure to themselves, you know, I want to be like them when I grow up. I want to be able to do something. And obviously, whenever they grow up, end up giving back to their community.
And Ely Anku, you said your first camp was in your hometown. Were you involved with your tribe and relations there before you did the camp?
I was definitely involved with my tribe. It's just something that's a little tough, obviously, because I'm from Ottawa. My tribe is out in Doki's Bay, which is probably like a 7-hour drive up to Ottawa. You know, it was kind of tough. So what we did was, for the first camp, we obviously we made it free, and we made it with a focus on kids from Ottawa. So basically, it was a free camp. You could attend as long as you register and whatnot. You can get your kids out there and kind of just have fun. But I think the main focus was also to just, again, get kids out playing, get kids out getting active. And we definitely succeeded in that goal. And I think for the next camp, it'll definitely be a focus for us to be able to go to Native American reservations, especially mine or Shana's.
Excellent. So your first goal of the camps is to improve resources available to engage kids in physical activities. Can you give us a better picture of what those missing resources look like? What gap are you trying to fill?
I would say, honestly, the majority of Native American reservations across North America are in pretty rural areas. Not a lot of reservations that have, I would say, the best accessibility to things like sports camps, youth camps, just things like that in general, due to the sheer location of where most of them are. So I come from, my family's from the Oneida tribe, and thankfully my tribe is actually, it's in Green Bay, Wisconsin, literally within the city, right next to the city limits, basically. So not all tribes are in the most rural places. My tribe is kind of one of the exceptions to that rule, but.
Do you know the history of that? I know a lot of tribes and Indigenous people were moved to these rural areas. It's not that your tribes probably stayed in Green Bay or for some reason was able to keep existing in Green Bay and didn't get relocated by the United States government.
They were, I think they were actually moved from New York.
It originated in upstate New York, actually. I forget what the exact area is called in upstate New York, but somewhere in upstate New York is where they originated, and then eventually over time they were pushed back to the Green Bay, Wisconsin area, and that's where most of my family is on my dad's side is from. Actually, half the family on my dad's side. I don't have any direct contacts to anyone on the reservation in New York. There is a pretty strong Oneida area in upstate New York, and there is a reservation there as well. I haven't been. I have some mutual family friends who have. But yeah, maybe one day I'll have to go out to New York and see what it's like out there.
That sounds like an amazing community. So landing in the Green Bay area was better than where a lot of Native and Indigenous people were forced to, these rural areas that had little to subsist on.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing with reservations is a lot of them do tend to be a little below the poverty level. So they don't, I mean, they're not necessarily the best conditions in terms of living conditions. And I think a lot of it probably has to do with the rural aspect of it too, how they're kind of just far away from any big cities or those direct access to resources that some tribes do have, but I feel like most really don't.
Yeah, the more you're pushed away from resources, the harder it's going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
So a huge part of your mission of the Dreamcatcher Foundation ties into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls movement. For our listeners who aren't familiar with that, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so basically it's a movement that addresses kind of like an epidemic that's going on in the U.S. and Canada. A lot of Indigenous women and girls are going missing and murdered, and a lot of the cases are not being investigated into properly. A lot of them are being forgotten and kind of being put to the side. And we feel as though it's something that we should definitely pay attention to. There's a very disproportionate amount of Native American girls and women who don't get to have justice, and also being in that position in the first place. You know, a lot of times these cases go uninvestigated, and that allows for a lot more to happen, a lot more negativity to happen. And so it's something that we feel as though should be addressed, and it's something we've definitely focused on this year. It's a new topic for myself, for Shayna, but you know, the more we're learning about this, the more we feel as though it's very important for people to learn about it.
Yeah, and our foundation, really, one of the goals of our foundation, aside from providing youth sports camps, is to shed some light on this crisis that's currently happening across North America, because it is very serious, and it's just so unfortunate that not more people know about it. I mean, I feel like most people in North America have no idea that this is happening, and that's a huge issue. And for us, it hits very close to home, us both being Native, our families being Native, so we just feel like it's the least we can do to just use our platform on both, through both the Dreamcatcher Foundation and both our social medias. We just feel a huge inclination to just shed light on this crisis as much as we can.
Yeah, as I was doing research for this interview, I read a statistic. The third cause of death for Native and Indigenous women is just going missing or being murdered.
Most people don't even know that, and it's just so unfortunate. Something this bad and this prevalent that's happening within our country, like across the entire country, it's just, I feel like just, it's crazy more people don't know about it.
It's not a new issue. It's been going on, I think, since the 60s or 70s that they are starting to research and look back.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of the reasons for why it is so unknown is because of the sheer fact that the lack of resources, of course, with these reservations, and also the fact that each tribe has their own tribal jurisdiction. So like they're their own sovereign areas of land, basically. They basically have their own police system, their own judicial system, and there's kind of like this separation between like federal, state, local government and police forces with these tribal forces. So there's kind of like this sort of like weird divide between within reservations and outside of the reservations in terms of data collection.
And rightfully, a lot of distrust. You'd think, well, why don't the two law enforcement organizations just work together? And then you simply have to look back at the history of either the Canadian or the United States government and say, why would they trust to to value the lives of Native and Indigenous people to work with them.
Yeah, exactly. There currently there is no exact record of how many Indigenous women are missing, though some things have been done in terms of bettering the system for data collection, including the Savannahs Act, which was just put into place in September, just a few months ago. So that pretty much just, it was created with the goal of improving the coordination and data collection between federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement agencies. It is one step in the right direction. I think it's a great start, but I feel like there is a lot more work to be done.
Sounds like the Dreamcatcher Foundation is doing a great job of promoting or elevating the cause and the idea. How do you see the sports camps fitting in helping both elevate the cause? Are the money of the sports camps going towards the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls movement? And do you feel like there's something preventative about your camps?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the mentality behind doing the camps is obviously being able to shape kids for the future. As we know, the older generations are eventually going to start disappearing, and so the newer ones are going to have to start picking it up, and so we have to kind of make our own way. And I feel as though being able to shape the youth in a way that we can encourage them to be able to I guess, help us in the fight to fix these issues, I think will be very helpful for us in the long run. You know, it's not necessarily a matter of getting money from a camp, because either way, money is going to be, it's going to be very helpful. And it's going to be very helpful in putting resources into, obviously, investigating certain cases. If people can be helped in terms of either their living situation, sometimes kids go without a mother because something really bad happened. And so sometimes you have to help support those families that suddenly have a void within their structure. And so that's something we feel as though we are able to help with. In terms of the long-term goals, we believe that being able to shape young people to be able to address these situations in their future would be collectively really good for everyone.
And you're not just working with girls, you're working with young boys as well, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not one side of the spectrum or the other. We feel as though everyone should be obviously included in this, but this is not just women's problems. This is everyone's problems that everyone should care about. We feel as though it's something that we can all contribute to.
So Shana Paulus, you're part of the Oneida Tribe of Indians of Wisconsin, and Eli Anku, you're part of the Ojibwe Tribe, whose lands cover a large swath of land. How did the two of you meet and start working together?
So we actually met in college, freshman year, literally like the second week of school. This was back in 2012. Yeah, 2012 is when we met. We started out as good friends, and it wasn't until a little bit later on that we found out we actually both shared Native heritage on both sides of our families, which was pretty cool. So it was pretty much just by chance that we ended up meeting. Yeah, it was pretty random. We just met in a dining hall at the UCLA campus.
So there wasn't a sports connection?
No, not really. Not initially.
Not really.
It was pretty random. We just met in one of the dining halls on campus.
I definitely talked about mountain biking a little more than, you know, I was capable of talking about it, but, you know, obviously, you know.
You were maybe fronting just a bit?
Maybe like a hair, but not too much. Obviously, I knew a little bit, you know, about mountain biking, but obviously she definitely knew her stuff a lot more than me.
Did you know how much more Shana knew than you did at the time you were trying to impress her?
I didn't know there was so much to know, I guess. but yeah, I mean, pretty much how we met, you know, with the whole, I guess, connecting with our own roots a little bit more was when further into our relationship, further into school, we decided to take Native American Studies classes together and kind of explore our own culture a little bit more. And that allowed us to get a broader view of the implications of what it is to be Native American. And we got to experience a little bit more of our own culture, study it a little bit more in depth. And I think that's at the point where Shana and I started seeing that there's a lot more going on that needs, not, I don't want to use the word fixing, but there's some stuff that we need to help with, because we are in a position where we can help. And I guess the way we were raised, I know for sure Shayna and myself, you know, if you see someone who needs help and you have the means to help, then that's just, it's natural, you have to. And so it just became a little bit more of a passion for the both of us to be able to be in that position. And so, you know, obviously with the years for me being in the NFL and Shayna growing and being out of college and, you know, being in the pros, it's just something that we were able to kind of start. So here we are.
That's great. Shayna Paulus, it sounds like you were racing and winning, looking a little bit back at your background, as early as high school in bike races. It sounded like you have a wide background in many athletics, but cycling somehow kind of hooked into you. How did you find your love of cycling, and how has it stayed so strong?
I would say ever since from a young age, I mean, I did my first mountain bike race when I was 4 years old, and I actually ended up winning that race. Today, I have actually pretty vivid memories from that specific race, actually. I still remember it. But yeah, that was like my very first race, and from then on, like, I was pretty much hooked. I mean, both my brother and I, my brother's a couple years younger, he's also a professional cyclist. We got started like around the same age. Like, we started riding when we were like 1 year old, and then got off training wheels by the time we were 2 years old, and we're both racing by the time we were four. So he's pretty much followed in my footsteps in that regard. I mean, it wasn't just cycling, honestly. Like, we were both involved in so many different sports growing up, everything from soccer, gymnastics, volleyball, basketball, swim team, triathlons. I would say it wasn't until probably more so middle school that we started getting a little bit more serious in like sports such as cycling and triathlons. I would say probably it was first and foremost triathlons. That's when we kind of started getting more serious. And then we competed in everything from like junior Olympics to USA Triathlon National Championships throughout middle school and high school even. And then I would say probably towards the tail end of high school, junior year, that's when I really just kind of knew that cycling was the sport that I wanted to primarily focus on the most, because that's just kind of what I always tended to gravitate the most towards and just realized that I had the most passion for. And a lot of me realizing that stemmed from participating in the NORCA High School Mountain Bike League freshman through senior year. That was also something my brother competed in as well. I mean, it wasn't just the high school league. We also did races outside of that league, so like local races. We were still kind of doing triathlons for like a club team outside of school as well, which we traveled around quite a bit for. We did Xterra mountain bike triathlons, and then as well as road triathlons. But we always kind of knew, you know, triathlons are three sports combined into one. And we both obviously had our favorite of those three, which was cycling. So that was kind of always something that we both gravitated towards, and we knew that we favored more than all the other sports. So yeah, junior year, I decided to stop doing triathlons and like track and field and cross country. So yeah, it was junior year, and then senior year, I was pretty much just focusing entirely on cycling. That's kind of where it all began for me, and I've been doing it ever since.
So it sounds like you had a very sports-focused and supportive family to have those experiences. Is that something you want to be able to bring to some of the kids you're going to be interacting as part of the Dreamcatcher clubs?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of my goals as an athlete, I mean, and as a person in general, is just to help inspire the next generation of young athletes, not just girls, but boys also. People ask me all the time, oh, what are your goals as a professional athlete? Like, what do you hope to achieve in the long run? And one of those things, I mean, it's always the same. Like, one of the things is to help inspire the next generation and just set a good example for that next generation of young kids coming up, and hopefully inspiring them to some level where they also want to get into the sport of cycling.
That's great. And how often, I don't know how much you've done of visiting reservations or communities, do you see cycling even as just like kids riding bikes, being a part of that community?
Yeah, actually, a couple years ago, I was able to host a couple of mountain bike clinics on a couple different Native reservations, one of them being the Red Lake Nation Reservation in Minnesota, upstate Minnesota. And I got to go out there. I got to visit the reservation. I stayed with a couple of our family friends, one of whom is actually Oneida as well. So I stayed with him and his wife, and they also served as one of my sponsors to be able to host the camp. I hosted a couple community rides with the kids from the reservation there. I went out, we met, and I hosted like a little Q&A with the kids and just talked to them quite a bit about what it's like being a professional cyclist and also what it means to be Native and a professional cyclist and the importance of that. And then afterwards, we went on a little fun community group ride. I think it was like just a couple miles or 3 miles or something. But it was super fun, and it was great because all the kids who showed up, some of them showed up with their whole families, like their parents too. So it was just a really good group of people. And they all showed up and they all had their own bikes too. So I was actually kind of surprised to see how many kids showed up with their own bikes. It was pretty special to see. And also just seeing like the sheer passion that they had for riding. It was really special. The next camp I hosted the following year was actually in Oneida, the Oneida and Stockbridge Muncie Reservation, which is about an hour from Oneida. So I actually got to host another camp out there where I just got to talk to the kids from each reservation. I got to talk with the kids. And then after talking with them and doing a little Q&A, just leading them on like a couple fun short community rides. So it was pretty much the same as the year prior, just different location. The first couple camps in Minnesota, actually, aside from doing the community rides, I actually got to go to some schools both on and around that Native reservation. And I went into their PE classes and got to talk with all the kids during each of their PE classes. And then at the end of the school day, we got to do like a little fun group ride from campus. So yeah, I love doing that kind of work. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do anything like that this year due to COVID, of course. So yeah, hopefully next year I'll get to do another one of those. Hopefully, incorporating the Dreamcatcher Foundation with it as well. So yeah, I'm excited to see what the future holds in terms of future camps.
Well, Shana Paulus and Eli Anku, thank you so much for joining us on the KBOO Bike Show today. If our listeners want to find out more about the Dreamcatcher Foundation and the work you're doing, where should they go?
Yeah, that'll be on the www.dreamcatcherfdn.org. Or you can simply find us on Instagram. It's dream_catcher_FDN. And you can kind of see all the work we do, and also events, possible future events, and a lot of information about the topics that we research.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being great human. Thank you for joining us on the show. And thank you for the work you've done and continue to do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. Thank you again to Sky Wildcat of the Cherokee Nation, Shana Paulus of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin, and Eli Anku of the Ojibwe Tribe for joining us today. We'll have links to the Dreamcatcher Foundation and to the Remember the Removal Ride, as well as contact information for guests if you'd like to learn more. Our podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by myself, Alon Robb, and April Streeter. We'd like to thank our web host, Chris Smith, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook at our Twitter handle at KBOO Bike Show, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike. I should have done instead.
cause, cause harm to the planet. Don't you wanna take a joyride on my tandem? Huffy on a huffy, don't I look so handsome? Bikes, the bikes, they so nice, like priceless. Working on my calves, the triceps, the biceps. Bypass the gas, stop the traffic lights. I get around, round without a driver's license. Hello, you walking? Farewell, I'm off then. And I'm whipping through the city with a 40 and a 50 party popping on my wheelie.
My phone tells me I should stop.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.